Let's see. I've been perusing a list of questions and things that have been posed here. This one's interesting. Why were all transmissions to be... I can almost read it. Why were all transmissions to be public via radio and television? Why were they... They were easily faked. Is that the contention here?
That's right, exactly. I found out something very interesting about the communications from the moon. First of all, they were all made at the gigahertz level, which is far beyond amateur radio operator capability. In addition, every transmission that allegedly came from the moon that came into Goldstone or to Woomera, the various inputs all over the Earth that received the alleged messages from the moon, all of these inputs were then transmitted by other means to Goddard Space Center in Washington. Now, my contention is that that gave them the perfect excuse to create whatever they wanted to create and have it originated from Goddard, because from Goddard there was a leased telephone wire that went to, of course, Houston, to the Manned Space Flight Center in Houston, and that is, of course, where everything ended up. So in other words, it was the easiest thing in the world for them to fake any type of transmission from the moon, because everything had to go through Goddard. Well, this, to me, meant that everything originated at Goddard. That nothing really originated from the moon. Let's take, for example, Roger, that famous telephone call between Aldrin and Armstrong on the moon, allegedly on the moon, and President Nixon on Earth. I've listened to that broadcast, and to me it just sounds like a hokey hoax. Because here you have two people chatting back and forth a quarter of a million miles, when most people that are involved with radio know that it's very, very difficult sometimes to get, say, a transmission from an airplane 30 miles away from, say, Washington, D.C. airport into the airport. And it's as though, you know, they were almost spoofing the public having this conversation back and forth. I think that's almost ludicrous. And of course, on top of that, we all know Nixon's reputation as far as reliability.
Yeah, that was what struck me as you were saying that. But not wanting to jump on Mr. Nixon, at least I don't personally. The other effects, the television transmissions. Now, obviously, these all could have originated at Goddard. Is that what you
mean? Right. Yeah, I claim that Goddard was the source for most of the communications.
Where did the did NASA get the? Now we're talking about a different kind of technology, but technology is definitely involved in what is known as special effects these days, and we've seen a lot of special effects in the movies lately. But this was quite some time ago. Where did NASA get the special effects expertise at this point in time?
Well, I'm glad you asked that. I found out that in 1965, while Stan Kubrick was making the film 2001, that his budget for special effects was mysteriously increased from $6 million to $11 million. And it's my contention that that money came from NASA. And he was given instructions to create the kind of special effects that could later be used to create the moon photographs, both still and motion picture. When you think about it, 2001 also served another purpose. It sort of manipulated and bamboozled the public into accepting motion pictures concerned with space, so that when the alleged moon landings finally took place, they would think, well, they can do it on the movies, but this is reality. In other words, it was a way of confusing the public, which is what our government really is very, very good at. And incidentally, before I forget this, I might forget this later on in the evening, there will be a new edition of this book to be published by Desert Publications in Cornville, Arizona. And I have the zip code here. It's 86325. Now, I don't know what the price of the book is going to be, but it's my understanding that it'll be available in March. So if anybody would like to get a copy of the book, just write Desert Publications, Cornville, Arizona, and that's 86325. So, Larry Moore, I've done my duty as far as...
we are talking about your book.
Yeah, that's true. Okay.
All right. While I was sitting there listening to you, I totally forgot what I was going to say. All right, why were the first astronauts held in quarantine? Quarantine. It's English. I should be able to read it. Why were they held in quarantine so long after their first trip?
That's a very good point. My contention is that the astronauts were really Manchurian candidates, that they were alternately drugged and hypnotized and brainwashed into actually thinking that what they were doing was they were going to simulate the moon landing. I think they knew this. I think they were aware of this. But the one problem that they would have had they been exposed to the press as soon as they got back from their alleged trip to the moon, if the press had been turned loose on these, particularly on Aldrin and Armstrong, the first, moon hoaxers, they probably would have been blown away by these questions. But when you think about it, if they had a 30-day cooling-off period in which, sort of a debriefing, you might call it, in which to talk to some of the psychologists that were prepping them into what to say and so forth, then it gave them an opportunity to sort of get their act together so that when they did go into press conferences, they felt more comfortable. Now, here's the interesting thing. When Aldrin and Armstrong came back, it was documented by NASA that at no time were they afflicted or affected by any germs on the moon. So my question to NASA is this. If the first trip to the moon proved that the moon is a lifeless planet, why then were the other astronauts put into quarantine on their return? In other words, if the moon was dead and harmless to mankind, why bother? But my contention again is that they needed to have this debriefing, this cooling off period for 30 days in order to get their act together, to get their story straight and so forth before they had to submit themselves to the interrogation of the press.
Well, since I've been shanghaied here to play devil's advocate, wouldn't a possible explanation, now granted, they've decided that there is no native life on the moon, but you've already made mention of the cosmic radiation, or rather the gamma radiation, that is so prevalent in airless space once you get beyond the shield of the atmosphere, that any human body carries microorganisms and bacterium, et cetera, no matter, even if they've been kept in a relatively stable environment for some time prior.
Sure.
That couldn't it simply have been the fear of possible mutation, or simply the idea that they don't know what happens to the microorganisms that man carries around with him? Wouldn't that account for the quarantine?
That's a very good point. That's an excellent point, and I'm going to take that into consideration. I'm in the process of adding to this book constantly. What you're saying then, Roger, is that man taking, if they had indeed gone to the moon, if he took microorganisms to the moon, that they could have gone through mutation, through cosmic radiation, and then returned with something that could have been lethal to life on this planet.
Right.
Yeah,
I think what made me think of that was the movie The Andromeda Strain, which what happened there. They'd sent a capsule with bacterium up into space to try to mutate it, and it got out of hand.
Right.
We got a question here that got passed to me, and I believe it's from one of the callers, one of the listeners, that, let me try to read it here. It says, you admit that the U.S. landed Surveyor spacecraft on the moon.
That's right.
Why then couldn't the U.S. land a manned spacecraft?
Well, there's a big difference, caller or listener, between landing something that is totally mechanical and landing a human being. I've been asked this question many times before because the Russians have landed various mechanical devices, they claim, and we claim we've landed Surveyor. And I'm willing to concede that they did land Surveyor. But here's my point. To take a human being to the moon requires an entirely different technology. In other words, we have to provide for air, for the proper temperature. There are psychological considerations. He's got to be fed. There has to be water. And then, of course, his waste products have to be recycled. The enormity of the problem of getting a human being to the moon and back was studied by the advanced research group at Rocketdyne when I was employed there in the late 50s. And they did a computer study of the difficulty of getting a human being to the moon and back alive, and the chances that they came up with statistically were 0.01 chance in 100. In other words, 1/100th of 1% of a chance to get a human being to the moon and back through all of the different obstacles and hazards and risks that that would have existed and do exist.
Perhaps it's a bit soon to get into it, but I'm curious that what about recent developments in the space program, limited though they have been since NASA's budget has been cut to the bone?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. One of my favorite topics now is the fact that the shuttle, which is supposedly going to make its first launch in March, the shuttle is now 2 years behind schedule. And I don't really think that was due to any budgetary cuts. It's due to the fact that technologically, it's very, very difficult to get something that's got as many parts as a liquid propellant rocket engine and all the peripheral equipment that goes with it to work successfully, particularly where you're going to expose human beings to risk. And I would like to go back momentarily to the incident in 1967 when Grissom, Chafee, and White were burned to death in a capsule safely on Pad 34 in Cape Canaveral. In fact, just before Grissom was burned to death, he made the comment, which was tape-recorded. He said, you know, they want to send us to the moon, and yet they can't even communicate with us a half a mile away. They were having trouble with the telephone communications between the control center and the command capsule on Pad 34, and Grissom made this comment. And I'd like to elaborate a little bit on Gus Grissom at this point also. Is that before he died in this flaming command capsule in January of 1967, Gus Grissom was probably the most outspoken critic of the Apollo project that NASA had. He was beginning to give unauthorized interviews to the press, and this concerned NASA very, very to a great degree. At one point, he hung a lemon on a command capsule, more or less expressing in this figurative way his feeling about the whole Apollo project. And here's the other interesting thing, that Grissom's opinion of Apollo, which was very low, was shared by many of the other astronauts. Walt Schirra once said, if we had as many goofs with Gemini and Mercury as we've had with Apollo, I don't think that this project's going to go. In addition to that, a man by the name of Sam Phillips, who was an Air Force general attached to the NASA project from the Air Force, once submitted a report to President Atwood of North American Aviation in which he stated that he felt that the Apollo project was, quote, literally falling apart at the seams. And this particular report by General Phillips agreed almost, if not word for word, certainly then in thought and content, with the report that Thomas Ronald Barron came up with to submit to Congress. So in other words, Roger, what we have is we have a number of people in the 60s saying that the Apollo project is very, very badly mismanaged, that technologically it's in very, very poor condition. That was certainly borne out by the burning to death of the three astronauts, and it was borne out by another incident that has now almost disappeared from NASA records, and that's Apollo Flight 6. All Apollo flights were numbered from 1 through the final Apollo Flight 17. It's very interesting that if you go to the library and you get a book on the Apollo project, that if you try to find Apollo Flight 6, it's very unlikely that you'll find any record of it. It's dropped into what I call an Orwellian memory hole, because Apollo Flight 6 was a total disaster. The second stage didn't light, the vehicle did not go into orbit, and they had to drop it down, you know, by radio command into the ocean, because it would have been a tremendous hazard. It could have fallen on New York City, you know, this flaming meteor. So they got rid of this Apollo vehicle before it did even more damage than it could have. So the point I'm trying to make is that we had a situation where up to Apollo 6, we had, by their own admission, 20,000 logged failures of the Apollo project. But after Apollo 6, and it's a very curious thing that one of the Apollo executives once said, I think what we're going to have to change are procedures. And what I interpret that to mean is that they were going to have to change the reporting of the flights. So by the time Apollo 7 was launched, what we had was total baloney. In other words, Apollo 7 comes across, it was a flight to man-rate Apollo, and it comes across as an absolutely perfect flight. Now let me make this point very, very clear, as Nixon would say. If you had an automobile that had ignition trouble and carburation problems, and it was spitting fire out of the exhaust pipe, and the windows weren't working, and it was overheating, and it had just all kinds of problems.
I have one of those.
You've got one of those. Okay. Well, would you, by any stretch of imagination, Roger, imagine that this car would suddenly, overnight, without really any time or energy being spent on it, and I'm talking about the time period, 1967 to 1969, would this entire turkey suddenly cure itself, suddenly become a whole, technically? To me, this is one of the most important points that I think I've ever made in my study of the Apollo hoax, and that is that sometime between Apollo Flight 6 and Apollo Flight 7, there was a complete change in the Apollo project from the standpoint of reporting the information. It seems as though someone took control of Apollo after the death of Grissom, Chafee, and White and said, okay, enough. We're tired of letting the public know what really happened. From now on, we're not going to report any information that is adverse. And by George, they never did. From Apollo 7 flight on, everything went perfect, with one exception. Apollo 13 allegedly failed. And I've discussed this with many people, and the consensus is that because public interest in Apollo was dying after Apollo 11 and 12, they had to put in a ringer. And you'll notice that Apollo Flight 13 failed at the optimum point in its flight where they could get maximum publicity out of this so-called failure of the flight to get to the moon and back. So when you think about it, Roger and listeners, what we're into is that just like our food is supposed to be great stuff and it's actually a weak poison, we're supposed to have the best health care in the world and yet we rank 37th in longevity. We're supposed to be economically sound, and yet there's no real money in our dollars or our coins. Social Security is bankrupt. In other words, I'm kind of winding up the whole concept of hoaxes here to align it with the moon hoax, is that the government has been expert at lying to the public for decades. I feel at my age that I have been lied to ever since I was a young man. And that's one of the reasons I've become involved, like May, with exposing conspiracies and hoaxes, is that I'm trying to get the message across, don't believe the government. Question authority.
Well, it's always been one of my favorite hobbies. I try to question everything possible. Let's see, I had a point. I mentioned earlier that NASA's budget has been cut to the bone, which is why Skylab fell out of the fell out of the sky. That we simply did not. They thought they felt they knew how to keep it up, but they didn't allocate the money to do so. All right, I assume you are convinced of the reality of the project, like Skylab and the space shuttle to come, or is that? Why would they carry the baloney this far, is what I'm saying. They've cut down quite a bit. Why wouldn't they just bail out altogether and drop it?
Well, I think what we have is an organization of some 300,000, 400,000 people that enjoy the high pay and the easy work and the short hours, and they're just trying to keep their project going. When I was involved in aerospace, we used to call it the white-collar WPA. We thought of it as sort of a relief program for the people who couldn't make it in the outside world. And I readily admit that right out of college, you know, I went into aerospace thinking I was going to be a big hero of technology and get involved in some interesting projects. And I simply didn't realize how poorly managed government projects are. That's why after a number of years I bailed out and I've never gone back. But to answer your question, I think that they wanted to perpetuate NASA. So they chose something that had public interest, like the space shuttle, and possible industrial applications, profit-making applications, which would give them corporate support. But now, whether the shuttle will work or won't work is still definitely a moot question. We'll know in March or April if and when they launch it. Like many other projects that the government has started, it could be canceled. I was with a program one time for an air-breathing missile that had a lot of money spent on it, and after 4 or 5 years of development, they suddenly canceled it. It was called the Navajo. And they decided that it wasn't going to work, it wasn't going to be any good anyway, and without any to-do, they simply said, okay, that's the end, and they just chopped it. They could do the same thing with a space shuttle. They could have reasons given for canceling it. The government is so expert at lying to the public that they won't have any trouble at all canceling the shuttle with, let's say, quote, acceptable reasons.
All right, we had another comment from, I believe, one of the listeners. What about Alternative 3? Are you...
I'm just vaguely familiar with that. I understand the contention of Alternative 3 is that some very wealthy people have set themselves up to bail out of the untenable situation on this planet and to establish themselves a base either on the moon or Mars or somewhere else, or to build a space station. And Alternative 3 being the hypothesis that a few select people will be chosen to leave this planet if and when a great cataclysm occurs, which, you know, we're talking about nuclear war, or maybe the polar ice cap melts and the Earth flips on its axis and the poles become the equator and vice versa. Many things could happen to this planet.
Maybe if we got together and voted in enough people to be sent off into space, we could avoid some sort of cataclysm. We could... Nixon perhaps might be willing for a seat. I don't know.
Well, that's true. We could get rid of some unpleasant people, that's for sure.
Well, we are nearing the end of our time here. I I'm curious. Now, I'm a science fiction fan from way back that I cut my teeth on Isaac Asimov, and I've been to the moon and way beyond a number of times.
Right.
In books, of course. Do you think that we ever will make it? Obviously, you think we haven't so far.
No.
Do you think we will? Do you think we should? Do you think the space program has anything to offer? A space program has anything to offer?
Well, let's see. I'll take those questions in turn. Will we ever go to the moon? I'll say that with the present technology that we have, no. With our policy of granting contracts to the lowest bidder, again, no. With the idea that corporations can just throw money around, waste it, and fool around as they did with projects like the Atlas missile program, there are many reasons why I just don't think that we can be successful technologically doing the things that we are doing the way we are doing them now. If money were turned over to a very dedicated organization that was free of governmental meddling and bureaucratic controls, then possibly we might succeed. The second part of your question, there we get into sort of geopolitics, the sociological aspect. Should we take care of the starving millions on this planet, or should we send men off into the space? Well, having been, you know, a parent and a father to children, my feeling was always, let's take care of the home scene first. In other words, if you've got immediate problems on Earth, you've got people, 1,000 people are dying every day of cancer in the United States. My feeling is that we should concentrate on the things that concern the people of this planet now. Here and now, do those, because this is analogous to some man whose children are running around barefoot and he's boogieing around in a brand new Rolls Royce. We give this money to big corporations to throw around, to waste on various projects, most of which never come to any good end, and yet we have, I read recently that 50,000 homeless women in advanced years are picking through garbage cans for something to eat in the big cities of America. And I actually saw this the night before last. I was in a little town north of here called Capitola, and there was a woman in tennis shoes and wearing a hat pulled down over her ears, and she had a big paper bag, and she was picking through a trash can, picking out various edible oranges and apples and so forth. So my feeling is, as we wind this up, that that the government has actually done us wrong, that we have been lied to, we have been manipulated, they are not to be trusted any further, and that the moon hoax is really just one of many, many hoaxes, just one set of lies that have been inflicted on the American people to their great detriment.
Well, our time has almost come. I've got to sneak this in. All right.
Okay.
That there is a condition that known as osteoporosis, which is the weakening of the bone structure. The bones begin to deteriorate.
I've heard of that.
There is an analogy that they have supposedly encountered with the astronauts, that away from the Earth's gravitational field, they call it astro-osteoporosis. In other words, that the lack of gravity and the lack of exercise causes the same sort of effect in the bones. Now, this is one instance where it may not have brought about a cure, but the application to space travel has pointed out problems and shifted emphasis to these problems, and that maybe that because of this we will have a cure on Earth for osteoporosis, just like we've done tremendous work with communicating with blind and deaf children,
right,
by trying to teach computers,
yeah,
how to talk.
Sure.
We've learned a lot about the speech mechanisms itself, that technology has a lot to teach us.
Oh, definitely. No, I don't discount or dispute with advanced technology at all. It's to our great benefit. My only fault big government for, let's say, wasting money that could be spent more suitably, more appropriately for problems close at hand, just as those you've just outlined.
Well, that makes sense. Well, our time is up, and that's it this evening for World Watchers International with our guest star. That Mae Brussell will be back next week to take over the show as regularly planned.
Thank you very much.
This has been World Watchers International with noted conspiracy investigator Mae Brussell. This program originates from Carmel, California.